How are you at making decisions? I read a story of a young executive who was making his way up the chain of command, and he got a promotion that he wasn't sure he was really ready for, and so he sought out one of the elderly individuals on staff, and he set him aside and he said, "I'm not sure I'm ready for this. How can I know if I'm going to do well?" The gentleman, in a very thoughtful manner, said, "Well, son, life is all about right choices." The executive said, "I understand that, but how exactly do I make right choices?" He thought for a minute and he said, "Well, right choices are born out of experience." And the young man said, "Well, exactly how do I get experience?" The elderly man thought for a minute and said, "Bad choices." The reality is that you and I make dozens of choices every day. This morning you got up and decided, will I hit the snooze a second or a third time? Will I have Cheerios or cornflakes? We're faced with numerous decisions throughout the day. Oftentimes they don't seem all that significant. But on occasion we're asked to make life-changing decisions. I think most of you realize that I'm a bit of a history buff. I enjoy reading about different areas of history, and one of my favorite eras is World War II. I've read several books, biographies, lives of different people who had a significant impact in that period of time, and I've also enjoyed a number of World War II movies. Several years ago, a movie came out entitled U-571. I don't know if you saw it, but it's basically the story of a group of American submariners who are given the task of taking a disabled German sub over. The primary reason is because on the German sub is an Enigma. That was the Germans' encryption device, and it was their goal to take the sub, steal the Enigma, scuttle the sub so that the Germans would never know. Well, the movie goes through, as you can expect, a number of twists of plots, and it comes to the climax, and the entire safety of the crew is down to one young man's decision.
"See here, we got no air pressure to fire the torpedo. One of these pipes is busted and it's leaking air.
How am I going to find it?"
"You'll see bubbles coming out. A lot of them. Find the isolation valve after the leak and crank it down. Got it?"
"Yeah."
"Every this hose you can bring through. Now listen to me. As soon as you finish, you get out of there. Okay?"
"Yeah."
"Trigger. In 1 minute, we're going to hit the surface. Do you understand me? Now you've got to go back in there and try. I wouldn't ask you if our lives didn't depend on it."
"Sorry, sir. I can't reach it."
"Listen to me. You can reach it. And you will. And you're going to close that valve."
"I can't get through it."
"You thank God." "And you're going to go back down in that bilge. You're going to do your job, sailor. you give up, Eddie.
I've often wondered, how would I respond if it was my life for the lives of others? Would I be willing to do my duty if it meant giving the ultimate sacrifice? The reality is most of us will never be asked that. But that doesn't mean that our decisions aren't equally important. If you have your Bibles, would you go back with me to the book of Hebrews this morning? We're continuing our pursuit in the course of the great heroes of the faith. And in chapter 11, we see individuals that can tell us some wonderful lessons. Abel gives us an insight into worship, and Noah gives us a life, an illustration of obedience. And I'm convinced that as we come to the story of Moses, we see an incredible picture of how to make right decisions. The story of Moses really begins in verse 24 of Hebrews chapter 11. And I'd like to just read down through verse 29 for you this morning. The author of Hebrews writes this: "By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt. Not fearing the king's anger, he persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on the dry land. But when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned." What do you know about Moses? I read the story of a young boy who went to Sunday school for the very first time, and he came home and his mother asked him, "Well, what did you learn in Sunday school today?" And he just kind of hemmed and hawed around, and she said, "No, I'd really like you to tell me." Well, he said, "Mom, we heard the story about this guy named Moses. He was some kind of a military leader, and he was leading an army, and they had to retreat. But when they were retreating, they came up against a great big huge body of water. And so he called in his engineers, and they built pontoon bridges across the sea. And they all crossed, but then the enemy tried to cross. And so he picked up his walkie-talkie, and he had them blow up the pontoon bridges. And the entire army died in the water." The mother said, "Son, are you telling me the truth? Is that really what your Sunday school teacher told you?" He kind of kicked the ground and said, "No, but you'd never believe me if I told you what she really told me." Moses is one of those stories. He's an individual who is just incredible to study because he does things that no one else does. In fact, in Deuteronomy, as Moses' life is given an incessant, in essence, an epitaph, as somebody picks up the pen, Moses has written Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, and most of Deuteronomy. But at the concluding portion of Deuteronomy, it ends with Moses going up onto Mount Nebo and God taking him. And then somebody picks up the pen and writes this about Moses: "But since then there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, and all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, before Pharaoh and before all of his servants." And as he stops to think about Moses, it is an incredible story of how God used a man in amazing ways. But it's also a story of a man who knew how to make right choices. And so for the few moments we have this morning, I want to just take a look at the choices that Moses made. The first thing I notice about Moses is that the choices he made were greatly influenced by his faith. In fact, in the verses that we read, beginning in verse 24 down through verse 29, the expression "by faith" is used four times. It's used "by faith Moses," and then in verse 28, "by faith he," and then verse 29, "by faith the people." And four times Moses is demonstrated as doing something out of faith. And so surrounding those four points, I want to just take a look at what Moses' faith did for him. The first thing I notice about Moses' faith is that Moses chose eternal rewards over instant gratification. In fact, the bulk of the story that we're going to look at this morning is really found in verses 25 to verse 26. And it begins with this statement: "By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter." We in America really struggle with the whole concept of royalty. We get occasionally some of the tabloid stories of Prince Charles or Princess Diana when she was still living, or Prince William. But the reality is that we have been conditioned from birth that we're not a monarchy. In fact, monarchies are evil. We're a republic or a democracy. And thus we look at the royalty with a bit of skepticism. In order to really appreciate royalty, you really need to go live in a country that has a king and queen. I had the chance to live in England for a month, and perhaps the most amazing thing to me while I was there was to get a sense as to just how revered the royal family really is. True, they've made some bad mistakes. They've chosen poorly often, but yet they are held to a standard above anybody else. And it's not because of what they've done, it's because of who they are. And if you dare to speak evil as an outsider of the royal family, you're going to find yourself involved in at least a verbal sprawl, if not an all-and-out fight. They love their royalty. That's nothing compared to ancient Egypt. In the time of Moses, the royal family, the Pharaoh's family, were absolute supreme dictators of the world's lone superpower. They had absolute power and absolute control and could do whatever, whenever they wanted. And in fact, Pharaoh took it to a second step. Not only was he revered for being royalty, he was worshipped as being a god. And thus, when it talks about Moses coming of age and choosing not to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, it was an incredible statement that he was refusing the power and prestige that his title gave him. I wonder what the conversation went like when Moses comes to his adopted mother's room and says, "Mom, thanks for spending 40 years raising me as your son, but I think I'm going to become a slave now. We'll see you later." It's unheard of. Humanly speaking, it doesn't make any sense. Why would you willingly set aside all of the power and prestige that is given to royalty? But not only was he willing to refuse to be powerful and to enjoy the prestige of royalty, it says, secondly, he was willing to go ahead and choose suffering over pleasure. It says in verse 26 that by faith Moses was willing to choose. In verse 26 it says that verse 25, he chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short period of time. I'm afraid sometimes when we talk about sin in the church, we really don't do a fair service. We sometimes want to paint sin as displeasurable, but it isn't. There's a reason why people are caught up in drugs, in sex, in gluttony, in pick your sin here. It's because it's enjoyable. I think Hebrews chapter 11, verse 25 is one of my favorite verses because it talks about the reality that sin is pleasurable, but the key is for a short time. It's not something that is enjoyable forever. I have, the past couple weeks, been reading through the story of David, and just this last week I came to the story that I'm sure you remember of David and Bathsheba. And as David was staying at home when the kings went out to do battle, it says that David was walking on his veranda and he saw a woman, and she was very beautiful. And he began to enjoy what he was seeing. And he began to lust after her in his heart. And he began to entertain the idea of just how much pleasure there would be. And because he was king, he brought Bathsheba in. And I'm sure for a few hours enjoyed incredible passion. But that's not where the story ends. It isn't long until Bathsheba's pregnant, and so now he's got to cover it up, and in order to cover it up, he's got to go to all kinds of lengths. He tries to get Uriah to come back and sleep with his wife. He refuses, so he has Uriah murdered. And then Bathsheba has the child, and as she carries the child, she watches the child die. And then as you continue the story, it is just so sad. As David's son falls madly in love with one of his sisters and rapes her. A second of David's son becomes so enraged at his brother that he puts in play a plan to kill his own brother. And because of that death, Absalom is sent out of the kingdom. And eventually David brings him back in but refuses to see him. And because of that rift, Absalom begins to go out into the kingdom and raise up support. And he overthrows his father's rule. Why? Because David enjoyed the pleasure of sin for a short time. Moses undoubtedly had every sin pleasure at his disposal. Wine, women, gluttony, entertainment. Pick your sin, and I'm sure it was available to Moses. And the idea of living in the palace where there were no constraints, no rules. He said, no, I'm not going to enjoy the pleasure because it's fleeting. And thus Moses decided to choose suffering. He literally chose to be a slave rather than continue in the pleasure of sin for a short time. But finally, he not only chose to refuse power and prestige, he chose suffering over pleasure. He regarded disgrace for Christ better than the riches of Egypt. A few months ago, we were looking at the subject of King Tut, and if you remember, we had a picture of some of the screens. I don't know if you've seen the images, I'm sure you have, of just the incredible things that were found in King Tut's tomb, of gold statues, of sarcophagi, actually three layers of a sarcophagus that had gold in each of them, and the funeral mask, they call it, that covered King Tut, just of millions of dollars worth of gold. And as archaeologists have studied King Tut, they've decided that King Tut was, by all accounts, a relatively insignificant pharaoh. He served just a short period of time, and during the time in which he served, he was relatively powerless by comparison to other pharaohs. If you go back and study the timeline, you will find that Moses was in the royal family at the very height of Egypt, at a time when wealth and riches would have been beyond anything we can even begin to comprehend. It would make Bill Gates look poor. Riches beyond anything you and I can comprehend. And Moses said, no, thank you. I am willing to choose disgrace rather than riches. Well, a couple things I want to notice about his decision before we go on is, first of all, it says that he made this decision when he had grown up. What does it mean to grow up? Well, in our society, we talk about growing up at about age 18. To a large degree, in the Jewish culture, growing up was at age 13. You had the bar mitzvah for males, and at age 13, you were considered an adult. But as you begin to put together the entire story of Moses, it's fascinating. It's found for us back in the book of Exodus, the first several chapters of Exodus. It's also recounted in a very brief manner in Acts chapter 7. And I encourage you to go back and read. It's actually Stephen's account in which he shares with us under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit some of the oral traditions. And according to the oral traditions, it shares that Moses was 40 years old when he finally grew up and looked at his life. I don't know about you, but that's encouraging to me. Because I'm roughly 40 years old. And even though I've made an awful lot of foolish decisions, you know what? There's still hope for me. In fact, you continue, Moses grows up at age 40 and goes out into the wilderness for another 40 years. And at age 80, he's finally actually ready to put feet to his faith. You know what that tells me? There are very few of you here this morning that are older than 80 years old. There is hope for all of us, no matter what we've done with the first 80 years of our life. Moses will become one of the greatest men in the history of Israel in the final 40 years of his life, from age 80 to age 120. There's hope for all of us. But secondly, not only was the decision made when he had grown up, but the second thing is that word regarded in verse 26. The idea of the word regarded is that Moses stopped and contemplated. It has the idea of counting the pros and the cons, carefully examining. Moses didn't make a brash decision. He didn't simply make a spur-of-the-moment decision. He thought hard. What are the pros of me staying in Pharaoh's home? What are the cons? And Moses, after considering all of them, said, I can't continue to enjoy the pleasure. I can't continue to enjoy the prestige and the power. I can't continue to enjoy the possessions. I'm giving them all up. Why? Well, I think we find the answer at the end of verse 26. It says, because he was looking to a better reward. He had his eyes focused not on now, but on eternity. We live in a day and age where everything is about now. If you were with us last week, we showed the video clip of the gentleman who says, I microwave my food, I use email to talk. In fact, you have probably sitting on many of your belts or in your purses a cell phone that will allow you at this very moment to talk to anybody in the world. We're all about right now. And it is so hard for us to truly be willing to take eternity's view. But it says that Moses looked eternally. You remember back in chapter 10, as the author of Hebrews was looking at those who were struggling, he said, sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution, at other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had a better and a lasting possession. Moses understood that completely. What he was seeking wasn't something that would be here for today and tomorrow, but something that would be here for eternity. And thus, as we begin to look at Moses' decision-making process, I think we see a man who was willing to look at eternal rewards, not just instant gratification. Secondly, I think not only did Moses look to the eternal, but he chose perseverance over fear. As you drop down to verse 27, you read this. It says, by faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. We need to step back just for a second and ask, which leaving is the author of Hebrews talking about? See, Moses really left twice. If you remember the story of Moses, I'm sure you remember that at age 40, he figured out exactly who he was, and he went down into the camp of Israel. And while in the camp of Israel, he saw a slave master beating a Jewish slave. And as he saw the slave master beating the Jewish slave, he becomes indignant and he slays the Egyptian slave master and buries him in the sand and returns to the palace. The next day he goes back to the Jewish slaves and he hears them talking and he says, are you going to kill us just like you did the Egyptian? And he becomes fearful and we read that Pharaoh tried to kill Moses. And so what does Moses do? He flees for 40 years out into the wilderness. He leaves in fear. He spends 40 years as a shepherd on the backside of the desert in a place that was untouched by that civilization, where Pharaoh couldn't find him. And finally, he's confronted with a bush that burns, and the bush is God speaking to him and saying to him, Moses, go back. And Moses goes back, and the second time Moses is there, he's confronting the king of Egypt, somebody who had absolute power to take his life. But he wasn't afraid. In fact, I'd encourage you to go back and to read Exodus chapter 10 and 11 and 12. As these 10 plagues are carried out, numerous times Pharaoh tries to intimidate him. He even at one point says, Moses, if I ever see your face again, I will make certain that you are killed. But Moses isn't fearful. Why? How is it that Moses can enter the throne room of the world's greatest dictator, the most powerful man on the planet, the man who has the ability to carry out his threats? Because it says Moses saw him who was invisible, and he persevered. Do we see him who's invisible? Or do we only see those who are visible? In fact, I'm afraid too many times our decisions are greatly influenced by the intimidation of other people. We choose fear over the right things. Moses said that he was willing to choose perseverance over fear, and he refused to be influenced by the Pharaoh. Thirdly, as you drop down to verse 28, not only did he choose the eternal over the instant, not only did he choose perseverance over fear, he trusted God's provision. Verse 28 throws together this incredible story. It simply says, by faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. We don't really have time this morning to go back and to look at Exodus chapter 13 and 14. It's the story of the Passover. But it is an incredible picture. It's a picture of God's deliverance. And in fact, while I was in India, I had a chance to speak most every Sunday night. Most Sunday mornings, Dr. Ironside spoke. And many of the messages, I must admit, I don't remember. But one of them sticks with me. He spoke on the Passover, and he drew these two fictional characters. The first was the son of Pharaoh. And he built this picture in our minds of what it was like to live in Pharaoh's household. It was a palace that was surrounded by an armed guard at all times. It had high walls. It had doors that were unable to get into. And then once you got into the palace, there were many doors that were protected. And he said, imagine the son of Pharaoh living in the safest, most secure place in all the world, protected by the strongest and most able of soldiers, preparing to go to bed one evening. As he lays in absolute confidence, there's another boy, other side of the city, not in a palace, but in a shack. And as he's in the shack, he begins to hear his father tell the story of what Moses had shared. He shared that Moses has said that there is an angel coming. An angel coming to kill the firstborn in every house. This angel will take the life indiscriminate of who you are or where you are. But God has provided this lamb. And as he shows them this spotless lamb, he takes the sharpened knife and he slits the throat of the lamb and he places the bowl under the throat of the lamb and he collects the blood. And he says that we are to take this blood and we are to paint it on the doorposts of our house. And this blood will protect us from God's wrath. Who do you think slept better that evening? Who do you think awoke the next morning? I think oftentimes those who are caught up in their sin don't realize the danger that they are facing. And sometimes those of us who've grown up in the church and have heard the story of God's Lamb, I don't think it's any coincidence that when Jesus comes and dies on the cross, he does so at Passover because of the incredible imagery that it is simply the blood of the Lamb that keeps us safe. But how can blood protect? I can just imagine the questions of that little boy. But Daddy, is that enough blood? Did you put it in the right spots? Are you sure we shouldn't sacrifice a second lamb? How do you know that I'll be safe? And the father comforts him by saying, we are simply allowing the lamb God has provided to protect us. Moses was willing to step out in absolute faith of the provision God offered and enjoyed God's safety. But finally, he not only trusted in God's provision, he finally acted. He stepped out. He believed God's promises. In Exodus chapter 14 is the story of the crossing of the Red Sea, and it is an incredible story. And I'm sure it's a story that you've heard many times, but there's a part of the story that always amazes me. In Exodus chapter 14, you see that Moses is leading the children of Israel. They're following this pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, and they're making their way out, and suddenly they begin to hear that the armies of Pharaoh are coming to return them, and they begin to become scared, and Moses continues to lead them following this pillar until suddenly he realizes that they're trapped. On both sides are mountains, and in front of them is the sea. And as they are trapped with the prospect of Pharaoh's army coming, Moses says, "Be still and see the provision of God." How would you like to have been in that group when this man stands up and says, "Just wait, God will provide a way"? But what I also like is if you continue to read the story, God then turns to Moses and says, "What are you doing standing there? Lift your staff and start walking through the water." Wait a second here, God. That sea's big. How exactly is my staff going to provide a bridge for 2 million people to cross? I'm sure as the thoughts went through Moses' head, there must have been many. But we simply read that Moses then went and lifted his staff, and God parted the sea. In an incredible testimony of God's strength and God's provision, he parted the sea, and the children of Israel, all 2 million of them, walked through on dry water. And then as soon as the armies came, we suddenly see that as they tried to pass, what happens? The Egyptians came and they were drowned and gone forever, as God provided. The story of Moses is one that we could certainly have spent hours on, weeks on. But this morning, I just want to ask the question, how can Moses' life help you? May I suggest that these four things that I see in Moses' life are something that can help me? First of all, anytime I have a decision that I'm trying to make, the first question I need to ask is, what is the eternal perspective? What does it look like from eternity's perspective? Am I going to be happy I did this a billion years from now? Am I willing to take the eternal look? Secondly, not only am I willing to take the eternal look, I must refuse to be intimidated by others. It doesn't matter what others think. It doesn't matter what others say. It doesn't matter what others will do. I must be willing to do what God would have me to do. But not only must I take the eternal look, not only must I refuse to be intimidated, I must rely upon God's provision. And then finally, I must be willing to actually step out and act on God's promises. Jim Elliot is an individual that my guests, most of you, have heard of. He grew up and graduated from Wheaton College in the early 1950s. And at Wheaton, he was a standout. He was a wrestling star. He was a gifted speaker, a gifted writer. And many people began to slate him in as one of the leaders of the church, particularly in the Midwest. But as he was graduating, he began to feel God's call on his life, not to those who had heard the gospel, but to those who hadn't. He eventually, in 1952, graduated and moved to Ecuador. But even while in Ecuador, he wasn't content simply to take the gospel to the tribes that had the gospel, but wanted to go to the tribes that hadn't. And he began to feel God calling him to the Aucas. The Aucas were a tribe that were known for the brutality. In fact, just a couple years before Jim Elliot would arrive there, a number of Americans who were working for Shell Oil were brutally butchered by the tribe. And yet he was not deterred. And I think most of you remember the story of how he and Nate Saint and several others made their first contact, found them brutal, and they were gored to death and left for dead on the beach. And it's easy for me, for you, to say, what a waste. A young man, his whole life in front of him, gone. And yet I believe Jim Elliot's life can be summed up in one of his most famous quotes. When asked why he would leave the States and go to Ecuador, he said, "A man is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." Moses had more than you and I will ever imagine having, and he gave it all up to gain something infinitely more valuable, the praise of God. this morning, I would challenge each of us, when we're forced to make those decisions, to take a look at eternity, to refuse to be intimidated by others, to rely upon God's provision, and to step out in God's promises.